Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Apologies if you've been unable to get onto the website, thehemingwaylist.com, in the last 24 hours or so. The subscription for my Podbean subscription, I host through Podbean, expired. It only expired for like 5 minutes. I quickly went and fixed up the billing problem. But for some reason, during that 5 minutes of being expired, it deleted all the domain information. So once I restarted the account, all the podcasts were still there and everything, all the stats and all that, but they just decided, yeah, Mr. Bill, we'll delete all your settings. So for some reason, the URL was down. Apologies. Also, don't use Podbean if you're ever going to start a podcast. It's like premium prices for a pretty shitty service that usually goes wrong in some way. Bitterness aside, if I can put my bitterness aside for one moment, we are here to talk about part 7, chapter 22, of Anna Karenina. Yesterday's discussion prompt actually seems pretty spot on now after today's chapter. So yesterday, or the day before yesterday's chapter, my prompt was just, I think I fell asleep during this chapter, what did I miss? Which was funny because then the following chapter that we read yesterday was about how all the characters had fallen asleep as well. So it was like, oh, maybe that was the desired effect. It seems I wasn't the only one who fell asleep. Maybe the author actually wanted us to get drowsy because it seems to have been what was happening to all the characters in the situation in the room. What was going on here? Hypnosis, boredom, drugging. Swim said the mama fishy said spiritualism is going on. According to Wikipedia, the movement originated in the state of New York. Spiritualism first appeared in the 1840s in the western and central regions of upstate New York. Spiritualism is a religious movement based on the belief that the spirits of the dead exist and have both the ability and the inclination to communicate with the living. The afterlife, or the spirit world, is seen by spiritualists not as a static place, but as one with spirits, in which spirits continue to evolve. These two beliefs, that contact with spirits is possible, and that spirits are more advanced than humans, leads spiritualists to a third belief, that spirits are capable of providing useful knowledge and about moral and ethical issues, as well as about the nature of God. Some spiritualists will speak of a concept which they refer to as spirit guides, specific spirits, often contacted, who are relied upon for spiritual guidance. Spiritualism developed and reached its peak growth in membership from the 1840s to the 1920s, especially in English-speaking countries. By 1897, spiritualism was said to have more than 8 million followers in the United States and Europe, mostly drawn from the middle and upper classes. Note, it makes sense that St. Petersburg aristocracy would be all over spiritualism, since at that time of Anna Karenina, they were mad for all things English and European. By the late 1880s, the credibility of the informal movement had weakened due to accusations of fraud perpetrated by mediums, and formal spiritualist organizations began to appear. Spiritualism is currently practiced primarily through various denominational spiritualist churches in the United States, Canada, and the United Kingdom. I can't believe that's still a thing. What planet are we on right now? So something that was invented in the 1840s and then debunked by mediums, which is also bullshit, there's still people that are like, no, I'm going to stick with this spiritualism thing. A strange world. I like it though. It seems so common, right? Spirits, the spirit world, having a spirit guide. What's your spirit animal? Like, it's funny to think where that actually comes from. It's not that long ago. Poor Karenin. He seems too sensible for his spiritualism, for this spiritualism nonsense, says TA131901. Welcome to the podcast, TA131901. Steve is walking on eggshells around Lydia, and Lando was pretty funny. Swims to the Mama Fishy said, thank you for this comment. I went back and read the chapter and you're spot on. Karenin was too sensible until he fell in with Lydia and it is nonsense. Steva is a rogue in the worst sense, but I like him. I like him not to get got up in all this. I am Norwegian, says Welp. Guess we won't be getting a happy ending, at least not for our main character. Earlier in the book, a preacher was mentioned. This guy was the guy who spread the whole faith alone idea among the St. Petersburg upper classes. That's the Christian side of it, but Lydia, who managed to drag a vulnerable Alexei into her fashionable take on religion, also seems to have managed to drag Alexei into spiritualism. This kind of mystic spiritualism was also a popular thing among the upper class, both in Russia and Britain, probably elsewhere too. Now, look at Rasputin. He did basically the same thing with the Romanovs. All of this was new and alien to Steva, which caused him to tire quickly from trying to tactfully maneuver in all of this nonsense. It's a weird structure, this book, isn't it? I really feel like War and Peace was so much better in its structure. Whereas this book, like, we're reading the ending of the book right now. Like, essentially, we're reading the ending. And they're like, oh, now there's a spiritualist. It's like, I know he was mentioned earlier in the book, but there's just, I don't know. It doesn't feel like a, you know, if you look at your story plot, where you've got rising action and then a climax and then, like, the resolution to that climax and then an ending. We should be in the resolution of a climax right now, but I don't feel like there was a climax. I don't even really feel like there was that much conflict other than just kind of fluffing around. And I'm not feeling a resolution at all. And we're about to end the book. Weird structure. Thermos of Beer said, I'm kind of curious what others think of this book so far. Well, I think I just told you. This is my first time reading AK, and I feel like it's unnecessarily long and a bit meandering. Yep, I think we're both kind of feeling the same thing at the moment. I also think Anna Karenina isn't the best choice of name for this book, as it also feels to me it's about Levin 70% of the time. Anna is kind of a side character in her own book. I find some of these chapters pretty dull, to be honest, and the story a bit lacking. 100% with you, yeah. 100% agreed. If someone asked me to sum up the book to this point, I'd say this lady named Anna cheated on her husband, ran off with her lover, and this guy named Levin got married and had a kid. That's about the gist of it. This feels like a marathon to me, a marathon where I shit my pants at mile 10 and decided to keep running. And now at mile 22, I figure, since it's dried and I've come this far, I might as well finish the race. I don't mean to be a downer, and I honestly hope the rest of the group is enjoying the book more than I am, but I am just curious how others feel up to this point. Yeah, I agree with you. I like the prose style. I like how Tolstoy writes a sentence, how he writes a chapter, the structure of it. There's no pretense to it. You don't feel like he's showing off too much. Whereas Dostoevsky, for me, was just insufferably showy-offy. Like, he was just... It was just a man masturbating for 2,000 pages, really. Like, let's be honest. All those intellectual back and forth between the characters was just one man having an intellectual back and forth with himself. And it's like, this isn't that entertaining, man. Like, what did you think of this in the shower when you know when you have those fake arguments in the shower with someone and you're like, yeah, and then I'd say this and then my comeback would be this, and it's like way smarter than anything you'd actually ever say in real life. That's what Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov, I should say. The Brothers Karamazov specifically, that's what that was for me. So I am enjoying this book a lot more than that. But saying that, I enjoyed War and Peace a hell of a lot more than Anna Karenina. Coralette said, I like this book a lot. It's true that there's not much plot and some chapters are really boring. For me, that what makes it great is all the little moments where something just feels super real. I empathize with the character, or it reminds me of part of my life, or I've seen other people behaving the same way the characters do. Tolstoy poured so much detail into this, and it feels very vivid, really vivid to me. I do think reading one short chapter a day makes it harder. I think some of the boring sections were maybe 20 to 30 minutes of reading, less if you skim to get through it, but that stretches out over a week at our pace. But when I was reading several chapters a day to catch up, I enjoyed the book more that way. No worries about it being a downer. I always love to hear what other people thought of the book, whether they loved it, hated it, or anything between. I in-betweened it, is what I did. I didn't hate it, that's for sure. I've actually quite enjoyed reading this book. I think compared to the last few books we've read on the Hemingway list, I like that it has nice short chapters. That might just be because of my commitment to the podcast where, you know, when I sit down and see a 20-page chapter, I'm like, oh, I'm tired. I don't want to read 20 pages right now. So I like that every day when I sit down to read this book, it's 3 pages, you know. What was I saying? Oh my God, it's completely blanked. Where am I? No, I am enjoying it. I am enjoying it. I like the prose. It's so readable. I don't feel like I read a sentence and then have to go, wait, what did he mean by that? And go back and like try to decipher it. There's no deciphering, which is just such a luxury after something like that terrible translation of The Brothers Karamazov, or that The Enormous Room, where it was like, what's the point of this, what you're saying right now, kind of thing. Thermos of Beer said, I don't hate it. I just feel a bit meh about it. It is wonderfully written, but I'm still just waiting for something to happen that gives me the wow, this is definitely worth it feeling. And at this point, I just don't really think it's going to happen. It's like Seinfeld. It's a book about nothing that just follows these characters' lives, except it isn't funny. Speaking of funny, my War and Peace Bogan edition is coming along nicely. I'm just going to go off on a little tangent here for 30 seconds. Someone asked me about it the other night at my band's gig, and I'm like, oh, you know, I'm really happy with it. A few people have read it and said it was really funny and they loved it, and where's the next one? But a bit underwhelmed. And then I was like, but it's funny when you write a book that, like, then you'll catch up with someone you haven't seen for ages, and they'll be like, oh, I saw you've got a new book. That's really cool. Or they'll have read it. And it's just like, you know, you kind of forgot that you even had that book, but it's still out there in the world doing its thing. It's just an underwhelming feeling. Anyway, so I was saying that to the singer in my band when I was catching up with him at the gig. And then, like, not 5 minutes later, I ran into an old high school buddy who wasn't there for the gig. It was just his regular bar, and I hadn't seen him for years. And he goes, oh, I saw you've done this War and Peace thing. It's really cool. And I'm like, oh my God, I just said how random it is that when that sometimes happens. And then it happened. But yeah, War and Peace is a lot more readable than Anna Karenina. The characters, you care about the characters a lot more. And all of them. There's a huge cast of characters, but you do start to feel attached to. I'm going to say there's like 20 characters in War and Peace, at least, that I feel invested in and attached to. And like you're rooting for them, or you're despising them actively or whatever. Whereas in Anna Karenina, there's sort of no character that I'm that engaged with. I wouldn't care much. I don't think there's any character in the book that I would care if they died, pretty much, put it that way. The thing I love about my own translation of War and Peace, not to toot my own horn, but the thing I'm proud of, I should say, is that I've taken a really readable book and just added sprinkles of humor, and it actually makes it a very, very readable book. So, I don't know. Check it out if you haven't already. There's a few chapters you can get. I think you can get most of the first book, like the first 12 or so chapters, over on the War and Peace subreddit. You'll dig it up. Swim said, the Mama Fishy said, What you are describing is why I read ahead until I finished. The pace, starting in part 6 and continuing in part 7, became excruciatingly slow for me until it started killing whatever enjoyment I had in the story at the beginning of the middle. Since I finished the book, I've been enjoying the comments and his musings on the podcast, thank you, and actually commenting myself occasionally without feeling so darn annoyed. I firmly believe that Tolstoy dragged it out to fulfill magazine serialization requirements and make a buck. Read ahead, end your suffering, you'll feel better. No, don't read ahead, stick with me, guys. Come on. We march together, one step at a time. Now, do what you want. Do what you want, but still come and discuss it every day, as Swims the Mama Fishy is doing. Chorolette said, what Lando said in his sleep doesn't really seem related to the divorce. But it already seemed Karenin didn't want the divorce, so I guess he didn't need much of an excuse. You think he just interpreted in his own... the way he wanted to. That's kind of what people do, isn't it, with spiritualists? They give you some vague notion and you just interpret it in the way that you actually want. Like, you just interpret the advice that you're hoping to get. Should I go to the casino? And they'll be like, the future is unknown. And you're like, it is unknown. You're right. I am going to go. It's like, did you just want to go to the casino, man? I think you might have. Chapter 23. Old chapter 23. Classic. Let's have a look at it. It goes like this. Before any definite step can be taken in a household, there must be either complete division or loving accord between husband and wife. When their relations are indefinite, it is impossible for them to make any move. That sounds like an opening line of a book, doesn't it? Let me read that again. Before any definite step can be taken in a household, there must be either complete division or loving accord between husband and wife. When their relations are indefinite, it is impossible for them to make any move. So you need certainty. Yep, got it. Cool. Profound. Many families continue for years in their old ruts, hated by both husband and wife, merely because there is neither complete discord nor harmony. Both for Vronsky and for Anna, in life in Moscow, in the heat and dust, when the sun no longer shone as in spring but burned as in summer, when all the trees on the boulevards had long been in leaf and the leaves were already covered with dust, was intolerable. Nevertheless, they did not move to Vozdvizhensk, as they had long ago decided to do, but stayed in Moscow, which had become obnoxious to them both, because of late there had been harmony between them. The irritation which divided them had no tangible cause, and all attempts at an explanation not only failed to clear it away, but increased it. It was an inner irritation caused on her side by a diminution of his love for her, and on his by regret for her sake. And on his by regret for her. Yeah, no, I'm reading it right. Let me try this again. It was an inner irritation caused on her side by a diminution of his love for her, and on his side, omitted word, but I'm adding it, and on his side by regretted. Oh my God, Tolstoy. Caused on her side by a diminution of his love for her, and on his side by regret that her sake, that for her sake. What is wrong with my brain right now? I cannot read this sentence. All right, 10th time's a charm. It was an inner irritation caused on her side by a diminution of his love for her, and on his by regret that for her sake he had placed himself in a distressing situation which she, instead of trying to alleviate, made still harder. Neither of them spoke. Congratulations. Round of applause for me, everyone. Neither of them spoke of the cause of their irritation, but each thought the other in the wrong, and at every opportunity tried to prove that this was so. For her, he, with all his habits, thoughts, wishes, mental and physical faculties, the whole of his nature, consisted of only one thing, love for women, and this love she felt ought to be wholly concentrated on her alone. This love was diminishing, therefore, in her judgment. Part of his love must have been transferred to other women, or to one other woman. She was jealous, not of any one woman, but of the diminution of his love. Diminution. So what is this? It's like diminishing. Diminution of his love. Not having as yet an object for her jealousy, she sought one. At the slightest hint, she... Am I having a stroke? What is going on here? Oh, wake up. At the slightest hint, she transferred her jealousy from one object to another. She was now jealous of the coarse women with whom, through his bachelor connections, he might so easily have intercourse. Now of the society women whom he might meet. Now of some imaginary girl whom he might marry after repudiating her. This last jealousy tormented her more than anything, especially since, in an expansive moment, he had carelessly told her that his mother understood him so little that she had tried to persuade him to marry the young Princess Sorokina. And, being jealous, Anna was indignant with him and constantly sought reasons to justify her indignation. She blamed him for everything that was hard in her situation, the torture of expectation, living betwixt heaven and earth, which she endured there in Moscow. Karenin's dilatoriness and indecision, her loneliness, she attributed all to him. If he loved her, he would fully understand the difficulty of her situation and would deliver her from it. That they were living in Moscow instead of in the country was also his fault. He could not live buried in the country as she desired. He needed society, and so he had placed her in this terrible position, the misery of which he would not understand, and it was likewise his fault that she was ever parted from her son. Even the rare moments of tenderness which occurred between them did not pacify her. In his tenderness, she now saw a tinge of calm assurance which had not been there before and irritated her. It was growing dusk. Anna, all alone, awaiting his return from a bachelor dinner party, paced up and down his study, which was the room in which the street noises were least audible, recalling in detail every word of their yesterday's quarrel, passing ever backwards from the memorably offensive words of the quarrel to their cause. She at last got back to the beginning of their conversation. For a long time, she could not believe that the dispute had begun from a perfectly inoffensive conversation about a matter that did not touch the hearts of either. Yet it was so. It had all begun by his laughing at high schools for girls, which he considered unnecessary and she defended. He spoke disrespectfully of the education of women in general and said that Hannah, her little English protege, did not at all need to know physics. This provoked Anna. She saw in it a contemptuous allusion to her own knowledge, and she invented and uttered a phrase in retaliation which should revenge the pain he had caused her. "I don't expect you to understand me and my feelings as an affectionate man would, but I did expect ordinary delicacy," she said. And he really had flushed with vexation and had said something disagreeable. She did not remember her reply to it, but remembered that in answer he had said with obvious intent to hurt her too, "I can take no interest in you, your partiality for that little girl, because I can see that it is unnatural." The cruelty with which he annihilated the world which she had so painfully constructed for herself to be able to endure her hard life, the injustice of his accusation that she was dissembling and unnatural, roused her indignation. "I'm very sorry that only what is coarse and material is comprehensible and natural to you," she retorted, and left the room. When he came to her in the evening, they did not refer to the quarrel, but both felt that it was only smoothed over, not settled. Today, he had been away from home all day, and she had felt so lonely, and it was so painful to her to feel herself at discord with him, that she wished to forget it all, to forgive and make it up with him. Wishing even to blame herself and to justify him, she said to herself, "I am to blame. I am irritable and unreasonably jealous. I will make it up with him and we will go back to the country. There I shall be calmer." Unnatural, she suddenly remembered, the word that had hurt her most, though it was not so much the word as his intention to pain her. "I know what he wanted to say. He wanted to say that it is unnatural not to love one's own daughter and yet to love another's child. What does he know of love for children, of my love for Sirza, whom I have given up for his sake, and that desire to hurt me? No, he must be in love with some other woman. It can't be anything else." Then, realizing that in her attempt to quiet herself, she had again completed the circle she had already gone round so often and had returned to for her former cause of irritation, she was horror-struck at herself. "Is it possible that I can't... Is it possible that I can't take it on myself?" she wondered, and began again from the beginning. "He is truthful, he is honest, he loves me, I love him. In a few days I shall get my divorce. What more do I need? I need calm and confidence, and I will take the blame on myself. Yes, now, as soon as he comes back, I will tell him I was to blame, though in fact I was not, and we will go away. And not to continue thinking and not to yield to irritation, she rang and ordered her trunks to be brought to pack their things for the country. At 10 o'clock, Vronsky returned. All right, there we go. Another chapter, Dune. Reminded me, a passage of that reminded me of a passage of something else. And I won't talk about it now, I'm going to talk about it in tomorrow's episode. But, interesting little comparison I just made in my head, which I think you'll be interested to see too. So you just have to tune in tomorrow. Thank you very much for listening today. See you tomorrow.